Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Pam Warhurst, co-founder of Incredible Edible, chair of the board of the British Forestry Commission, and a speaker at the TED Salon London in the spring of 2012. She came to my attention due to her TED Talk, which was sent to me by my production assistant, James. You can find a link to that talk in the show notes. You may want to start there before listening to the rest of our conversation because it builds on that presentation. I was struck by her work in planting edible landscapes because it happens with volunteers, not using a whole lot of money, and often without permission. As I learned in our conversation, it's also done without a lot of endless talk and meetings. Incredible Edible and the work that they're doing is a movement about action, but it's also about more than just food. They're educating people, growing businesses, offering a hand up, and building community in a way that helps to build not only a better world, but a kinder one as well. Rather than go on about all those elements and everything that left me very inspired and speechless, I'd rather turn this over to Pam and her own words. I'll join you again for a few moments after the interview.
If you could give me and the listeners a little bit of your background and how you came to the Incredible Edible Project, and then we'll move into the interview proper.
Okay. I've been involved in the private and the public, I'm 60 too. So I've been involved in the private and the public sector for a long time, and I've been leader of a local authority and chaired a health trust and advised government on things and whatever, whatever. And over the past 30 years, I've come to the view that it's about time we did it for ourselves, and that's why I invented Incredible Edible. That's the background, really.
That takes us quickly and directly into the conversation, then. So you see this movement with Incredible Edible to be a community and personal empowerment movement to grow our own food and take care of ourselves?
That and a lot more besides, I think. It started with food because it just struck me that the missing link here was people just knowing how to start to try themselves to build a kinder world. And it just struck me that there were oodles of problems around the corner, but it was really quite difficult to know where to start. But food does it, doesn't it? Food is a universal language. Whatever your age, your income, your culture, you eat it, you grow it, you buy it, whatever. You like it, you don't. But food, it's kind of a leveler. So for me, getting people involved in growing local food, sharing it, learning about it, is the first introduction to feeling a heck of a lot better about yourself and starting to think, actually, you're part of a solution, not a problem. And I think that's got to be the right way to think about life.
You find that a solution-based movement or a solution-based lifestyle is a better way to go about living and to really make a difference in your own life?
No, Scott, absolutely. I mean, I don't want to minimize the big issues that are on the horizon, and everybody, you know, will know about those, whether that's personal issues about health or your kids' jobs or whatever, or whether it's the really biggies around the environment. But negativity, doing the negative doesn't get you very far. You know, you may momentarily get a mild moment of excitement with a placard, but basically, I think we all collectively can do such a lot to make the spaces around our lives more productive, more environmentally sensitive, just give us a sense of pride around them, and we could all do such a lot to reconnect with each other and help each other more. But it's not just about being worthy, because I think the whole essence of what we're trying to do is to say, take action, do something positive today, and think about where you live and who you connect with, and think about adopting what we just call the Incredible Edible model of community meets learning meets business. Put local food at the heart of that and see where you go.
As you talk about this, one of the things that comes to mind is there's a lot of conversation locally about returning civility to our public discourse so that we can have conversations to bring about solutions. And that makes me think of some of the derisive issues here in the United States. Are you finding that the Incredible Edible Project and the work that you're doing cuts across cultural, socioeconomic, and political lines?
Absolutely. You know, in many ways, to say something as simple as let's focus on local food and let's really see if we can change the way that we live by thinking about local food and how it's grown. It's almost so simple, many people would laugh at it. How can you possibly deal with the big challenges by doing that? But actually, the simplicity is its strength. And what I've seen in, you know, the many, many rooms I've spoken to groups of people in and the many conversations I've had around this, is the wonderful thing about it is its simplicity turns the light on behind people's eyes. And you can see them in a room and you can see that they get what you're talking about. Do something positive. It's your gift. You don't need to ask permission to do it. Start with the spaces around your lives. Share, learn, and then support. This is a really simple message based on local food, but it's really inclusive. We've got loads of examples where people who were perhaps from culturally different backgrounds have reconnected. We've got loads of examples where those people that don't normally get involved in movement, some of the most challenged individuals from an income perspective or a health perspective, can actually see what their bit of the jigsaw is. And in starting to do something, it's contagious. You never stop. It's a very inclusive approach to helping people help themselves to build a better world.
And even though we're sitting here talking about it right now, it sounds like a lot of the progress that you're getting is because you're actually out there doing the work and that you're providing the leadership by being out in the community doing, rather than just attending meetings and talking all the time, that you get people to see the action.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. I've spent a long time in the public sector and I've, you know, had my own business as well and so on. And the simple truth of the matter that resonates with everybody is we know in our bones we don't need any more reports and we don't need any more strategy documents. We don't need any of that lot, actually. That's procrastination. What we need is to take our own bit of responsibility. And it's not all about growing, because there are many skill sets needed to build an edible world. Yes, of course, propaganda gardens are the first things that you think of. Spaces where, in very public places, you can turn an unloved bit of land into a herb garden or an orchard or a veg plot or whatever. You know, and that's fantastic. You also need the skills of people who can then interpret that, who can do beautiful signage that says, hey, when it looks like this, please don't pick it because it's not ready. But when it looks like this, help yourself. Or we have the wonderful, wonderful lady who runs our website. She won't mind me saying this. She's 68 year old and she's taught herself how to do it. And if anybody looks at our website, it's fantastic. It's a huge resource that Estelle has dedicated the last 5 years into making really, really central to what we do. And on top of that, then it's how do you go out onto the street or in the park or where people are and cook it up and show people how to eat well with low-cost food. And then how do you actually help young people in the schools and so on and so forth. There are many, many, many skill sets that you need to make the world edible. But the simplicity of the focus allows for what I think of as maximum elaboration from every skill set in the world that you can imagine would have a significance and a resonance in trying to build this kind of world.
And there are several things that you said there that key off of ideas within the permaculture model, which is useful for my listeners, is that bringing in all these different people, you're integrating your community rather than segregating it or dividing it off. One of the other tenets that's given to us by one of the founders is this idea that the Permaculture Prime Directive is to be responsible for yourself and your descendants. And that idea of personal responsibility while still being a part of your community is a lot more inclusive than just that idea of I'm going to stand on my own. And I'm just sitting here with a big smile on my face because of the way that all of this interoperates and the way that you can not only make a difference in your own life, but for those people around you.
Well, absolutely. I say all the time, there's nothing clever about this, and there's nothing unique about this. What it is simple and inclusive, and what it is replicable. So wherever we live, we can be kinder. Wherever we are, we can see spaces that collectively we can put into good productive use to grow edible food, to grow flowers or whatever it might be, and to share it. And in doing that, I've just come today from the most exciting meeting in Leeds, actually, because often people say, oh, it can only work on a small scale. Well, actually, it's only limited by your imagination, because as you say, it's a way of living. That's what this is about. And in Leeds, one of the local universities, and particularly a small group of people that are staff at that university, have absolutely got this message and are creating the very first, to my knowledge, incredible edible campus in Leeds that is taking the green spaces that their students and their people that live in the community around this large university would pass every day of the week and turning them into edible landscapes. But not only in edible landscapes, bringing the people that live in those areas, many of which haven't got much money, into the equation, teaching them new skills, allowing them to help themselves and pick their own, and then joining the dots with the schools along that campus trail so that you start to spread and join and just see that cross-fertilisation that a little bit of passion and magic brings. And they're now connecting with the city council, and they're now connecting with voluntary groups, and it's going to be really exciting. So I've had real evidence today that this can work on a much bigger scale.
The part of me that's always interested in restoring our landscape and the ecological design side of things, I listen to that, and as you're installing these edible landscapes, as you're transforming those green spaces, you're creating space for pollinators. You're supporting your bees and your butterflies and all of these other things, and it has this broader reach as we focus on ourselves and food and our community, how that then radiates out into the wider world as we take care of ourselves.
It's really interesting, isn't it? What this whole humbling experience of the past few years has made me realize is the power of small actions is what will drive forward change. Collectively, what we do is just so much bigger than those individual parts. It's been quite humbling, as I say, and it's very exciting to think that when we're teaching about local food, we're teaching respect across species, because, as you say, so many people just don't realise the importance of insects and pollinators. They just don't realise it. Why would they? They're not often taught it in schools. By incorporating a little bit of fun into what we do, for example, in my town, we were kind of thinking, how could we maybe help some of our small shops that are struggling, independent stores, cafes, whatever it might be? And how could we do that at the same time with promoting local food, telling people the story of pollinators or whatever? So we just made up, because that's just the way we do it, what we call the Incredible Edible Green Route. And that was simply a route, a walking route from our railway station that took people past some of our existing propaganda gardens, but took them along the route, say along our canal towpath, which we made edible, but included in signage the stories of pollinators. And then a guy came along, fabulous guy, who created a willow structure for us, which was a really interesting kind of little, I don't know, kid-sized structure. And the children would be encouraged to go in one side, and then it's rather a wiggly road till you get out the other side. And then when you pop out, it says, you have just done the waggle dance of the bee. And then it tells you what the waggle dance of the bee is. Now, it's fun, puts a smile on your face, it's not abused, but it's a really cute way of getting people to start to understand that we don't live on this planet alone. But not only does it do that, actually it attracts even more people to visit our town and have a wander around. They're not exhibition sites, but they're interesting and they're well signed. And then that helps people to walk through our shops, our small shops, or have a drink in our local cafe or buy at our local market, because that's the way the route takes them. And suddenly, you're starting to think local, and you're starting to think about the power of small actions, and you've done it all by having a smile at the same time.
One thing that came through in your TED Talk was that this is all volunteer. The fellow who built the willow waggle structure. Was that a volunteer project?
It was. What we did was we actually won a competition. We weren't going to do this, but there was, it was called the People's Lottery, and we won some money. We had to tell the story of why we wanted some money to improve our town. So we wrote the, as volunteers, we wrote the brief, which was we want to enhance the green route with the story of pollinators, and we want to get kids interested and so on and so forth. And we recorded a really short piece, we being the volunteers, about how passionate we were about it, and we got some money, which was great. And that allowed us to do much of this green route. What it did was one of our volunteers, who is also an artist, it allowed us to pay for his materials so he could create these wonderful sculptures for us. It's not that we don't need money. It's just not the place we start from in our head. You know, we only look for funds when we've either run out of our own or it would be madness not to, because it's going to cost quite a lot of money, like the aquaponics unit that we're building at the back of the high school, where we got some additional funds to do that. But it's going to be a great learning experience for those children who will walk through that edible landscape, that will be growing fish completely sustainably, and will be learning about permaculture, and will have bees in the orchards and whatever else it might be. So, yeah, we do everything as volunteers. We've got spin-off companies that we've helped kickstart, because we're trying to encourage young people to stay in jobs where they will provide the food for that locality. And these social enterprises, which we set up, one is called our aqua garden, where we're growing the fish and the plants and the trees and the whatever jointly with our high school. And that now has three apprentices. And it's also a learning, an edible classroom, if you like, outdoor classroom for the kids of that school. And the other one we call our incredible farm, where everything is grown with permaculture in mind. And we've got community groups there. But it's also another learning experience. And it's also a really positive experience for people with mental health issues. So those are spin-offs where people are employed. But the group of people who do all this stuff are all volunteers. And that's the way it must be.
As I said before we began the interview, to me, that's rather incredible that your organization continues to grow and thrive off of volunteers as much as it has with the, here at least, the number of projects that I've been involved with or known folks who have been active in that kind of start and then slowly go away, and then you're just left with kind of these shadowy remnants. Do you think that part of your success has been that you're out in the community and providing leadership through action?
I think that's right. I think there are a number of reasons why we seem to have got our message home to so many individuals. I think, first of all, Scott, it's time. I think we are at a watershed moment in our history, and I think people really want to start to think about a more sensitive way of living, if you want to put it that way. So I think the tide is with us, as it were. I think because everything we do is very demonstrable, you know, we're demonstrative. We do our propaganda gardens. We've got a very inclusive website. Everything's open access, whatever it might be. Helps people to understand, oh, yeah, I get that. Okay, so that's where I can grow or whatever. But the other thing is, I think, and it, maybe it's the age thing, maybe it's because we've been around a lot of blocks in our life, you cannot do this with speed. This is about trying to embed a different culture and a different way of life. And we have become such an instant society. We think if we haven't turned around the way that we've been living for the past 50 years in a three-year program, we've failed. Well, we're not. This is our sixth year that we're in now. And we can see traction, of course we can. But we were never expecting to see miracles so early in a program. We have it's a forever program, this. So you need to allow people enough time to say, oh, no, I get that. I want a little bit of it. And that doesn't mean to say everybody in the world is going to be a volunteer, because that's just not how it works. But it is quite interesting that We're not seeing the fall off in volunteers because we were never naive enough to think we were going to pool hundreds from day one. But when we've got a planning meeting, 20 volunteers will turn up. When we've got a learning meeting, another different group of volunteers will turn up. When we're thinking about putting on a food fair, a different group of people will turn up. And people slowly are moving from volunteers to specific responsibilities when it's an organic movement. So, for example, we have a lot of visitors to our town who travel around and look at what we're growing. So we have tour guides. We started with one, and now we've got four, so we can spread the load. They're not huge numbers, but they're slowly spreading that responsibility. We now have two groups of people who go out every other Sunday in groups of about 12, different groups, maintaining our town centre beds. When we've got a harvest festival and we're doing a big cooking, we'll have dozens of people helping us and hundreds of people there. So you go at the pace of the community, but because it's a really simple proposition, people want to do it. And what we've noticed is that we did a quick survey of people, residents in Tottenham, with a young man who came to visit us from Italy because he'd heard of what we'd done and he wanted to help. He was a student, a mature student. And some of the figures are really quite interesting. You know, 50% of the people interviewed said that they had now started growing their own edibles because of what we'd been doing. That's great. That's the sort of impact that we want. So if people are embracing it in their lives, that'll do for me.
That side is pretty incredible. And the other part of it for me that really struck me from watching your TED talk was that you reiterated several times that you're doing a lot of this just without permission. You're just going off and doing it. What is that experience like? Have you encountered much pushback?
No, not at all. It's quite interesting. I suppose you have to be a little bit canny about where you would start, I would say. But you see, we started by taking areas of land that had been completely unloved. You know, where people took their dogs or they threw their cans or whatever people do the world over when something looks pretty grotty, nobody makes an effort to tidy it up. So we did, on the sides of roads, we would just tidy them up, plant herbs, plant the odd fruit tree. And before you knew where you were, people weren't letting their dogs foul the area. And actually a bench would appear that somebody kind of donated. It's really quite interesting. And then we did something. We certainly talk about our experience, but we did something in the front of the health centre that was no longer used. And it was a real mess, actually. So we built some raised beds in front of this derelict health centre and planted vegetables with help yourself in. Now, the really interesting thing about that was nobody stopped us doing it because nobody actually cared about that piece of land. But about 12 months later, I was speaking to someone on the health side, and she said, you know, I love what you've done there. If you ever want to do anything else like that, let me know. I mean, it was just amazing. But then, of course, there have been other occasions when we have asked for permission. For example, the new health centre that I always cite as ridiculously being surrounded by prickly plants that people can't eat, we did go to the doctors and we did ask if we could take those up and put edibles there. And they did say, as long as it wasn't going to cost them anything or they didn't have to do anything, we could do it. So we did. And I think collectively, it's not that people will never complain. I mean, you know, we wouldn't march into somebody's private front garden without their permission and do that. That would be terribly unkind. We're trying to build kindness, not, you know, confrontation. But the way I look at it is, this is a gift. Right, we want to, if we can, just in our own way, ham-fisted though it might be, build a bit of kindness in our societies. This is a gift. It may not be that everybody wants it, but it is a gift. So, who's going to complain about that? I think people can be a bit braver, actually. I think authorities sense when people are trying to do something to help each other. And most times, the authorities get out of the way.
Just as your project is all about Incredible Edible, the story that goes with it is fairly incredible too. And that it's such a positive process, and that you are able to productively do so much just by going out and doing it.
It is true. And I think for me, the magic comes when you start to see the cross-fertilization between the community work, between the learning work, and between the business-inspired work. When you start to see around a town or a neighborhood or a borough or whatever, that people have been inspired to think about local food differently because of the propaganda side of it, and they've wanted to learn more about how to do things, so we share our experience and any skills that we've had around maybe grafting a tree or how to cook the cheaper cuts of meat or how to grow herbs, whatever it might be. And that collectively, those people who are mums and dads then have an influence on the school a little and what's happening in the school. So provided you play enough time into it, you start to get children learning more about the environment, of living soils, of pollination, and even horticulture. And out of that, you get the potential for apprenticeship, which takes you into your business side of things, because people start to look out for local food, and we give local market traders who sell local food blackboards, really cheap and cheerful blackboards with Incredible Edible on the top, and they chalk up whatever is local, beef or milk or cheese or bread or whatever, and that attracts more people to buy from their stall, which gives them more confidence to produce more local food, with the potential of taking on another apprentice or wood. And suddenly, in this really small but powerful way, you start to get those supportive circles of actions, which are what communities are all about anyway. And it does make me go cold, and I do want to cry, and I think people are magnificent, given half a chance. And I think it's just so fortunate that this idea plopped into reality and just seems to really excite people. I find it wonderful every day.
Something that you just said there, and I'm going to mangle this a little, was that people are amazing if given half a chance. I think that's close enough. All those times that people aren't given a chance, and how not having that opportunity doesn't allow them to grow, and thinking about what that means just to have that as an option.
Absolutely. It all sounds trite, and I don't mean it sounds right, but we are growing ourselves while we grow the food, obviously. And that's just how it feels, and it feels great to be part of a group of people who are doing that, and it feels great when I read some of the emails I get from all over the shop, from India and Australia and New Zealand and Africa and whatever it might be, of ordinary people who are saying, this is what I adore, I really love this, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to speak to my neighbour, we're going to have a bash, we're going to grow in our front gardens, and I know that's not popular in all parts of the world, but I think it's a great idea. There's no reason why it should be done in the back. And I'm going to share, and whatever. We didn't start this entire process with very highfalutin ideas about organic or permaculture. We just started, in the first place, with the idea of growing. Because we recognise that so many people are so far away from some of those environmentally sensitive ways of thinking that we just needed to whet their appetite. So we started growing. But we kind of worked on an assumption, which I think is the right assumption, which is once people become interested, they tend not to want to poison their children. So basically, once they start to question the soils. They start to question the planting regimes. They start to think about the seeds that they're collecting or whatever. And slowly, they come to the conclusion that there is a better way to grow the food that we need, that respects other species and is done through a living soil base. So they just come to that, but you don't start with that because it just feels just a little bit too far for a lot of folk. But you're right, people, truly, are magnificent. And for me, in this country, in England, when our local government sector is really constrained on finances, this austerity thing that we're feeling is a big deal. But what we're trying to offer, and that's why I think local authorities and the powers that be are so helpful now, is that we are saying you don't have to do everything to us anymore. What you need to do is to create a framework for our lives so that we can do so much more ourselves. And that resonates with them because, you know, people in authority, it doesn't make them feel good to say no. It's a really negative feeling. So if you can find ways of getting them to say yes, it's so much better.
And throughout this process, you're building these trust relationships on an individual level between the volunteers who are helping to grow the food and the opportunity that you're providing folks who might not think of it otherwise, that kind of hand up that you give them by just opening the door to them and trusting in them to join you. And then at the same time, you gain the trust of your local council or township.
Exactly. And that's how communities work, isn't it? That's how communities work. We've just kind of like forgotten it a little bit. So again, there's nothing new here. We're just reminding people.
I just like that as you come together and you build community, this is one of those points that I keep coming back to. As you grow your community, you can do so much more with all the doors that you open than you might think about just as you sit by yourself and try to consider what your next action might be, bringing together all these different people and these different ideas.
It's absolutely true. There's a different scale and a different time for different types of events. But when we're talking about the way we live our lives, what we're teaching our children, what we're sharing, our neighbours, whatever, when we're actually thinking about those things, the only way to really make that work is through that local knowledge. That, oh, we really need to build a raised bed somewhere. Oh, I know where there's some wood. I know where they're demolishing a place over there. Why don't we go and get that? The only way, in times of hardship or otherwise, to really build the wealth inside us is to share our knowledge. And the best way we can do that is when we work collectively around a sense of place, I think, because you can do so much more for so much less and feel so much better about it.
There's so much more that I could pick your brain on with all this and all the information that you have available from the successes that you've had. But rather than do that, I think I'm going to take the opportunity to go view the website, do some more reading, and go ahead and take this interview and get it out to the world. Before we wrap things up, is there anything else that you'd like to share with the listeners?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the messages are simple. We need to, with a sense of urgency, build a kinder world for our children. There is a way you can start. Incredible Edible isn't the only way, but it's a really wonderful first step to working with others and making a difference. And the only thing I would say is, if you were ever just thinking about it, stop thinking about it and just do it.
I think that's a great message to end on, to take inspiration and move it to action. Thank you so much, Pam, for joining me and having this conversation. I've really appreciated it. It's been a great time, and I'm hoping that it serves to help others on their road if they've been questioning about taking that first step.
It's been great talking to you. Thanks so much.
And that was Pam Warhurst speaking about Incredible Edible and her experiences in Todmorden. Here is a message in this interview and with her work about taking action, of choosing to move forward, to do so in a positive way, setting aside the negative discourse that is all too common these days as the world continues to change in seemingly chaotic and unknowable ways. And in spite of all that, deciding to build something different. If you'd like to learn more about Incredible Edible, visit the website at incredible-edible-todmorden.co.uk or by following the link in the show notes. Also, if you could take 3 minutes and do three things for me, tell a friend interested in permaculture about the show, leave a review at iTunes or your favorite podcast site, and go to thepermaculturepodcast.com and click on the support tab and find out other ways you can help this show to continue and in turn grow. Next up for interviews will be David Holmgren discussing the path of permaculture from the development of the idea through to the present day and into the future. After that will be Steve Gabriel, who joins me to talk about agroforestry, riparian buffers, and mushroom cultivation, and a whole lot more. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.